always think of parents as being mature. Well, we want to think of parents as being mature, but today's guest says that's not always true. And in fact, she says there is a consequence when we grow up with parents who are unable to give us the emotional sustenance we need. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and welcoming today's guest, Dr. Lindsay Gibson. Dr. Gibson, welcome.
Thank you so much, Pamela. What a wonderful opportunity this is to talk about a subject near and dear to my heart, and it's fantastic to be on your show again. Thanks for having me.
Well, again, I am just really pleased. I think that the work that you do is critically important. And in fact, let me let the audience know that you are, in fact, a clinical psychologist in private practice with a specialty in working with individuals who are, in fact, adult children of emotionally immature parents, which just happens to be the name of your book, one of your books, Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, How to Heal from Distant, Rejecting, or Self-Involved Parents. The title, I mean, certainly says so much just in and of itself, but you know, this is not something that we necessarily want to hear. We like to believe the myth that all parents are instantly and immediately wonderful, mature, supportive. So what happens to these parents? How does this kind of parent come to be?
Yeah, that is a fascinating topic. And first of all, to get to that, I'd like to just explain that this was an insight that came to me listening to patients in psychotherapy, where they would be describing some difficulty they had with their parents or a crisis that came up or something that was bothering them. And I would listen to the account of the incident, and I would think, oh my gosh, they're acting like three-year-olds. And that was sort of the picture, the mind picture I had as I was listening to these stories. Later it occurred to me, oh my gosh, psychologically, they really are three-year-olds. So that led to the whole idea that these parents were emotionally immature and really acting more like little kids in their relationships than adults. The way that they get to be that way, Pamela, I think, comes from a transgenerational process of children over the generations not getting their emotional needs met. And there's a lot of trauma and separations that occur in these past generations that then get passed down from parent to child, parent to child. So these parents are, I like to think of them as being stuck in their psychological development. They're emotionally immature because they probably did not have a safe environment themselves, free from trauma, abandonment, unmet needs. They didn't get that, so they could only go so far in their emotional development. Then we come along and we might actually end up being able to develop further than they did, emotionally speaking. And that creates this situation where you have adult children who are actually psychologically more mature and more complex than their emotionally immature parents who have gotten stuck back there.
So I think the first thing that I'm hearing that I think is critically important so that we don't get stuck again is there is no blaming of the emotionally immature parent. They came to be that way through their own experiences. And it's difficult to give what you never experienced.
Oh, absolutely. And the blame doesn't take you anywhere. It sort of keeps you circling the drain of your own frustration. However, Pamela, I do want to say that it is critically important that a person identify and validate the experiences that they have had in response to the parent's emotional immaturity. In other words, we're not blaming the parent for being that way, but we are saying that we can say definitively, this is how their immature behavior affected me. And if you don't do that, things tend to stay extremely confused because, as you said at the very top of the show, when we are expecting them to be mature and giving and they're not, it just makes us so confused and so frustrated, and that leads to a lot of anxiety and depression a lot of times.
And certainly, I know, because you specialize in working with this population, the adults themselves have so much pain that you're able to trace back in some measure to the experience that they had with the parents who really weren't there. Physically might have been there, but emotionally not able to give, again, what they themselves did not receive.
Yeah, absolutely. The pain that people have, they often do not tie to these childhood experiences with a parent who was unable to give to them at an emotional level. One of the things that is kind of hallmark about the emotionally mature parent is that they're afraid of feelings. They get easily overwhelmed by emotion. Now, we might see them as being very emotional and even unreasonable a lot of the time, but they are actually afraid of deep feelings. So when you try to have an emotionally intimate relationship with an emotionally immature parent, they will become defensive or withdraw or otherwise let you know that this is not something they're interested in doing with you. And unfortunately, this happens at an early age, too. The young child appeals to the parent for closeness or understanding, and the parent withdraws or gets angry because they just can't handle a lot of intense feeling. So they become very reactive. In response to that, the poor child, at this point still a child, can only conclude that there's something wrong with them, that their parent doesn't receive their feeling and sort of stay with them in that to comfort them or to understand them. And when the parent can't do that, then they become very emotionally lonely, and then they grow up with this little hollow place in them where they're feeling like they're not really hooked in, they're not really authentically connected, and that also is a fertile ground for anxiety and depression later.
You just used the term emotional loneliness. For the child, now adult, who has grown up with the parent or parents who are emotionally immature, are they aware when they first come into your office that they are experiencing a sense of loss and loneliness, or do they typically come in with other identified concerns?
What a brilliant question, because that goes back to the discovery process of this whole phenomenon for me. And that is that when people come in, they're usually identifying symptoms like anxiety or depression. They also are having problems in their relationships, or they're not feeling good about themselves. So when they first come in, they rarely identify any of this stuff that's in my book because they really aren't consciously aware of it. That's because there was nobody alongside them, usually, that is helping them to conceptualize what's happening. Like, your feelings are perfectly fine. Of course you want comfort from your mother. It's not your fault that she's withdrawing or getting mad at you. This is her stuff. I mean, there was nobody there to do that. So people often don't make any connection between their current day anxiety or depression and what they may or may not have gotten emotionally in childhood. It's very interesting how they do come to that, though. And lots of times when we start getting down to, you know, sort of the essentials in therapy, people will spontaneously say, you know, I feel so alone, or I've always had this lonely place in me. And then they do talk about it, and then we can tie it back to their experiences growing up.
You just referenced mother. Is there a gender tendency in terms of the emotionally immature parent? Does that parent tend to be more female than male, or always female, or what are we looking at?
Well, actually, no. I think that the resilience that a child gets for living in life often gets its start in the relationship with the mother. And I might add here, mother in quotes, because it could be the father, it could be the grandmother. So we don't want to just use that shorthand by saying mother, but I tend to do that because the early caretaker relationship is so important. So if that's good, even if you have an emotionally immature, say, father, extended family, whatever, there's some resilience built in if you had that good connection to begin with. So we want to be sure that we're taking into account that both fathers and mothers are often emotionally immature in this kind of phenomenon that we're talking about. They show up differently. Like fathers may tend to be more aggressive or more active in their treatment of children that's not good for children, but mothers have their own way of also instilling guilt or not giving the kind of attention emotionally that kids need. So I would say that, yeah, it could be either parent. It's usually both parents, because parents tend to gravitate to partners who are about at the same emotional level as they are.
So parents tend to marry who they recognize.
Yes, and they recognize who thinks like them. They recognize the level of emotional reactivity and the way of thinking about things in simple ways as opposed to complex ways. There's a whole bunch of similar characteristics that they will gravitate to.
So for the adult who's sitting in your office or listening to our conversation or reading Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, how does one begin to sort of tease out whether or not what they're feeling does have a connection to emotionally immature parents? Because, as you know, somebody walking in, there can be so many reasons why one might feel, for example, anxiety, depression, etc. It's not always that they were with emotionally immature parents. So how do they tell? How do they identify this?
Yes, that's where the we as therapists have to sit back and let the data lead us. But I wrote my book because I wanted one of the possibilities to be that a person had emotionally immature parents. So you may be anxious or depressed about other things, but I really wanted to get it on the table that one of the biggest causes that I've seen can be in that early relationship and ongoing relationship. It's interesting, Pamela, when people come in and so let's say they have marital problems, or let's say they're feeling a lot of anxiety. I mean, of course you let them lead the way in terms of what the problem areas are, but it my experience has been that it's not too long before they start tying it together with their past spontaneously. Like they will compare their mate's behavior to one of their parents, or they will kind of have a memory, like this reminded me of the time when, you know, and their parents will come in. So once they open the door to that, then we can go there and include that. Also, one of the things I do in a therapy session is I always do a full history, as we all do, but I ask questions about the quality of relationship they had with each parent, I asked them who they were to their mother, who they were to their father, and asked them a little bit about, well, what happened if you were upset about something when you were growing up? What happened if you did something wrong? And these kinds of questions get at what was the emotional relationship atmosphere that you had growing up. And that's often how we get into that.
When you ask who they were to a mother or a father, what do you mean by that?
Another way of saying that would be, what was your family role to your mother or to your father? For instance, they might say, I was daddy's little girl, or I was my mother's confidant. She talked to me about my father when they were having marriage problems. Or I was the one that my dad hit first. I was always to blame for everything. So it's getting at how they knew their parent saw them and reacted to them within the family system.
You tell a story very early on about Wanda at the age of 7. Can you share that story with the listeners?
Can you remind me of the details of that a little bit, Pamela?
Wanda was the 7-year-old girl who you describe her as standing by a moving truck outside of her family's old house.
Oh, yeah.
What was going on with Wanda?
Oh, that was a perfect example. This is one of those places where people will have memory, when people have memories of the quality of emotional loneliness that they had in childhood. I'm so glad you thought of that, because I have so many stories in there. I get them mixed up sometimes. But this is a case where a 7-year-old girl, Wanda, as I call her in the book, she was not told anything about the move. Her family was moving. She was not prepared in any way emotionally. She just was standing outside with her parents and siblings by the moving truck, wondering what is going on. You can sort of imagine that as an adult. I mean, supposing that you came down one morning and, you know, your partner says, let's step outside, and there's a moving truck, and they're putting things in it, and you're saying, what's going on? And they're saying, we're moving.
It's
and
horrifying.
And you didn't know anything about it.
Right.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It's so jarring.
Yes, it's weirdly disorienting. It's sort of like, wait, life is not what I thought it was, and why didn't I know this was happening? So, one of the things that emotionally immature parents have real trouble with is their empathy is very poor a lot of the time, especially if there's any stress involved. So let's say Wanda's mother might be able to be empathic if she skinned her knee, or if maybe somebody was picking on her, and the mother was in a good mood, and she might be able to be empathic then. But when the mother is stressed, for instance, then Wanda might not get any attention. The mother might not even think about preparing Wanda for a move, because she's stressed and she goes into a very self-preoccupied place. So that's what had happened with this move. The parents were, as many emotionally immature parents are, totally preoccupied with their own issues and no room in there to think about what this might be like for their child. That's a classic experience from childhood that results in that kind of emotional loneliness. It's like you're all there together, but because there isn't this emotional intimacy and this sort of sturdy empathy for the child ends up feeling off balance, alone, and worried that there's something wrong with them, that they are not able to figure out how to deal with things. So Yeah, and a lot of people do relate to that incident because they feel like there were so many times in childhood where they didn't know what was going on, and that ends up making you feel very alone.
Dr. Lindsay C. Gibson, author of Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents and How to Heal from Distant, Rejecting, or Self-Involved Parents. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Dr. Gibson. Where a child has grown up in the kinds of environments that we're discussing, are there different ways that they tend to react, or are there different ways that they tend to try to soothe themselves, or what?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Well, unfortunately, one of the first things that children assume, and this carries over into adulthood, is that there must be something the matter with them if there is a problem in their relationship with their parents. So a feeling of unsureness about yourself and your worth can continue into adulthood. The parent has to be seen by the child to be wise and giving and smart and strong, because the child needs that in order to feel enough security to continue in their development. So children often persist in this idealization of the parent because they need someone to look up to, and they need to feel that they're going to be taken care of. So those are a couple of ways that kids deal with this issue. When they grow up, unfortunately, one of the results of that, though, is that they may pick people in their lives, could be partners or friends, who also are not there emotionally for them and who make them feel bad about themselves or question their worth. That often translates into marital problems and friends who are not really on your side when you get into adulthood. You tend to gravitate toward what you knew as a child.
So it sounds like if you're going to choose a mate, you're going to choose a mate who really does look like mother or father or whoever the primary caregiver was.
Yes, that's sort of the danger of this sort of childhood situation. However, it's really wonderful when the child does retain sort of a core of trust in themselves. And in those cases, the child develops enough self-awareness that they can feel how the parent is treating them. And kids, there are some very self-aware kids. They just seem to notice things a lot when they're growing up. And they can sort of tell that something's not right with the parent. They may not know what that is, but they don't fall for it completely, that it's all their fault and the parent is completely ideal. So those kids, and I include a lot of self-aware therapy clients in that group, they will do a thing where they may often pick a mate at the outset when they're still fairly young that will mirror the issues with their parent. But then once they live that, they can become open to a more reciprocal and genuine kind of relationship. And so you can find an improvement in their quality of relationships as they become more self-aware and as they realize what happened to them when they were growing up. It's not always the case. I mean, sometimes people have serial marriages that don't work out, but there is a lot of hope that when somebody comes along that really does meet your emotional needs, they listen to you, they cherish you. Yeah, that is beautiful when it happens, because that really helps you to have a different kind of relationship, not what your parents might have set you up for. I love to see that happen.
The kinds of coping styles that the adult children tend to develop for themselves, you offer an exercise to help one identify how their particular what their particular coping style is. Can you walk us through that particular exercise where they're learning about whether or not they externalize or internalize?
Yeah, there are two broad types of reaction to the self-preoccupied and non-empathic style of the parent. One is what I call an internalizer, and the other is called an externalizer. And basically, you can tell which one you are by how much thought you give to feelings and psychological causes and that kind of internal insight. If you are an internalizer, you like to go inside and figure out what happened. You're interested in motives. You're interested in feelings. You try to see if you can piece together why somebody did something. That all that activity is happening inside at a psychological level. That's one of your ways of coping. So if a parent says something that hurts your feelings, you end up thinking about it a lot. You end up trying to understand it. That's the internalizer. The externalizer basically deals with stress by finding fault with the situation or with the people involved. So they end up blaming others. They see themselves as victims. They don't wonder why people did what they did. They just object to it. And they tend to gravitate more to acting out their pain and stress, like substance abuse is a big one. Being highly reactive, even violent, is another. But their coping occurs in the outside world. They get into outside world struggles, whereas the internalizer tries to figure things out on the inside. Two very different kinds of ways of doing life.
Is there a difference, is there a gender difference in terms of how you will choose to cope, or does it just cross?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, Pamela, because you know, on the surface, you want to say, oh, yeah, men are more externalizers and women are more internalizers. And stereotypically, that may be true because we think of the stereotypes of the man who doesn't discuss feelings and he just reacts, he does something. Or we think about the woman who calls her girlfriend and wants to talk about what happened and what it meant and how they felt and what the other person meant. So we have those stereotypes. However, in psychotherapy, I have had plenty of male patients who are internalizers. And that part of it, which way you go, seems to be gender-free. In other words, a male internalizer will be doing the same thing that a female internalizer is doing. And also a female externalizer will do the same thing that a male externalizer will do. For instance, the female externalizer might be just as abusive, show a hot temper, react with violence. These things are kind of gender free, but I think culturally we get these stereotypes that it's going to be one way for females and one way for males, but we have to keep open to the idea that whichever gender it is, they can use either one of these methods of coping.
You heard me say at the very beginning that there's a way that we like to think about our parents, just sort of generically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There is also a way that society tells us we should think about our parents. And very often, your parent could have been an axe murderer and getting ready to do the same to you right there in that moment. And there are certainly people who will say, but she's your mom, he's your dad, you can't mm-hmm. fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. What do you say to someone who's grown up with these parents who, for reasons that we've already discussed in some measure, you know, it's not that the parent woke up that morning and said, I'm going to be a terrible parent. So we understand that, but they're so painful to the adult. What does that adult do?
Yes, it's like the old thing about honor your father and your mother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No matter what.
No matter what. Yes, they deserve your love and respect no matter what. And that's the kind of crazy-making, reality-denying thinking that if we blindly accept it, will really take us into a swamp of contradictions and illogic and actually denying the evidence of your senses. So we have to restructure that thought about honoring your father and mother and say, yes, we do honor them for a lot of things. We honor them for giving us life. We honor them for putting a roof over our heads. We honor them for doing the best that they could under the circumstances, absolutely. But that doesn't mean that, and it doesn't say that we love our parents. It doesn't say that we let our parents get away with whatever they want to do to us. It doesn't say that our parents should come first before ourselves or even our own families. If you think about it in terms of honoring them for their role as parent in your life, that's great. That's fair. But when we get into these cultural stereotypes that all parents love their children, all parents want what's best for their children, then you become so confused that you can't see your parents for who they are as individual people. And I think it's sort of like a challenge to look at our parents objectively and feel what it is that they make us feel and sort of know them. Now, then we're in a position where we might have compassion for how they became how they are. But we're also going to be conscious of their behaviors so that we're not pulled down the rabbit hole with them. So, yes, honor them, but do you have a choice about whether you love somebody? I don't think we can manufacture that. I don't think we can be guilted into having a feeling if someone has not treated us well. So, in my mind, I just release us from all of that and say we want to get good at dealing with our parents as real people and not keep an artificial idealization of them just because that's what the culture would feel more comfortable with. It just doesn't work at a psychological level.
So you know that there's somebody or some numbers of bodies listening who now their heads are spinning around because you've just said it's okay not to love your parents. How dare you?
Well, it's not like you get a choice. I mean, I'm talking about emotional honesty. I am saying you honor your parents or you honor anybody for the things that you can honor about them. I think that's a good way to live. But you cannot make yourself manufacture a feeling for someone when you don't feel it. And that's a source of a lot of anxiety and depression in people when they say to themselves, gosh, I should love my dad or I should love my mom, but actually, I don't feel that. I just feel angry and put out, or I don't want to be around her. I don't want to be around him. So if we can be honest about how we really feel, I think it begins to give us a footing to have a more real relationship with our parent, where we can take ourselves into account, we can see them for what they are, we can have compassion for that, but we don't have to guilt and shame ourselves into feelings that you cannot force yourself to manufacture. And that's okay. It doesn't hurt anything to have genuine feelings and to deal with the situation on a more realistic level. I think it only helps.
You know, I'm thinking about the times when I've heard in my office, but they're my parents. Love is an action word. I have to take care of them. I can't say they're my parents. You know, the work that you're talking about folks doing can be so hard and so complicated and creates, bring up initially so much guilt and shame.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I had a woman in my office one day who was struggling with just this sort of issue with her parents, where they wanted her to do something that would have, it would have been really harmful to her. She had health problems. She had a big family that she was taking care of on her own, and her parents really expected her to drop everything and come be with them when this was not necessary. This is an important point. You know, in an emergency or a real crisis, we sort of feel moved to do the thing that will make us feel like a good person. That kind of tends to happen automatically. But what emotionally immature parents do is they sort of manufacture situations, not deliberately, but it's just because they have such poor stress tolerance, where they do give that message that if you loved me, you would do this for me, or I'm your mother, you should want that kind of approach. And when that happens, you have to think about how this is going to go. And there are some times when you can't obligate yourself to a parent's needs without getting sick yourself. For instance, I had a client once whose father was in a nursing home, and he insisted that she call him every day, and that she call him every day at 5 o'clock. Well, this woman was working a full-time job. She had many responsibilities. She also had health problems. And when 5 o'clock came, she did not feel like talking to her dad. She just needed to decompress at the end of the day. Well, the father wouldn't allow her to do anything else. And she said, well, Dad, what are you doing at 5 o'clock that makes this so important? He said, oh, well, that's the best time for me because supper is at 5:30, and I don't want to miss that with my friends.
Wow.
So, you know, so when you're expecting your parent to have feelings for your situation and limitations, that often is not realistic. And when you put yourself in a position that I can only be a good person if I jump whenever they ask me to, I just don't think that's sustainable. We get tired and we get angry when we are exploited like that.
Dr. Lindsay Gibson, author of Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about how one figures out the emotional maturity of a potential mate. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Lindsay, we've been talking about the difficulties that arise when your childhood experiences had you with emotionally immature parents. So now we're at a point where, let's say, the individual is really understanding the impact of all of that on his or her life, but is now feeling really kind of nervous about how to make healthy decisions for themselves moving forward. So how does one begin to determine whether or not the person they're considering as a potential partner does in fact have the emotional maturity that could in fact make them or allow them to be a healthy partner?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a very practical question. I believe it's the last chapter in the book, I talk about how to identify emotionally mature partners. I think it's interesting how I think people can do that even at the level of, you know, some of the dating sites, the internet dating sites, because if you know the characteristics of emotional immaturity, you can have a lot of fun sort of identifying these qualities on somebody's postings on a dating site. You can actually get quite a lot of data by the way that they talk about themselves and their view of life. So, but let's look at the most foundational thing that helps people choose good partners, and that is you have to be in touch with your own true self. In other words, you have to know what makes you feel comfortable, safe, loved, respected, listened to. If you work on your own, on getting to know your own self, and that's what a lot of my actual individual psychotherapy patients are doing, when you get replugged in with your deeper self, you have, I think we all have, unless we've got some neurological impediment, but we are like the animals. We can tell when something feels good or not. We really can. We get talked out of that inner awareness by emotionally immature people who want us to be who they need us to be. But in therapy or in self-growth, if you get back to that, you will have reactions that are negative to emotionally immature behavior. Our true nature is to be treated well, to be seen, and to enter into emotional intimacy. That's where emotional intimacy is, where two people tell each other what's really going on at a deeper level and allow the other to do that back, something that emotionally immature parents have a terrible time doing because they're so defensive. They just can't let themselves be intimate like that. But let's think about, okay, so you're going on a dating site or you're meeting somebody for a blind date. How do you want to go about determining their level of emotional maturity? So one of the things would be you would be listening with those ears, according to some of the traits of emotional immaturity, so that you can sort of get that little ping of, ooh, that doesn't sound right, or, I don't know about that. That reaction is a good way of picking up on their emotional immaturity. But the traits of someone who is emotionally mature, Pamela, are that they're realistic, they're reliable, they do what they say they're going to do, they show up when they say they're going to show up, and they seem to have an attitude toward life where they're working with reality, not fighting it or blaming it. For instance, if they're having difficulties, they would be talking about maybe what they had learned from the situation and what they were going to do as a result of that learning in the future, whereas the emotionally immature person might be talking about who was making their life miserable and how they didn't think it was fair and on about the other person's failings, but they're not showing the maturity of creating a better life for themselves. They don't take everything personally. For instance, they don't get huffy or offended or sarcastic when you try to communicate with them. They respect your boundaries. If you say no, they accept it. If you say this isn't a good time, they accept it. They don't get their feelings hurt. They don't psychoanalyze you or second-guess your decisions. That would be when a person says, oh, well, what you really mean or what the real problem is that you're fill-in-the-blank. And that kind of, let me tell you what's really going on with you, that is a control move and a sign of immaturity. You know, at a real basic level, mature people are flexible, they're even-tempered, and they allow themselves to be affected by you and influenced by you. They listen to what you say, they take it in, they process it, and then later they let you know that they heard you. So that's a real important feeling when you're talking with somebody, to be able to feel like they are there constantly in the conversation so they let you know that you were heard. If they can laugh and be playful, oh my gosh, that's that is a real plus. And if you feel seen and understood and you feel safe and you enjoy them, that's pretty much it. I would like to add just one other thing, and that is that they like to comfort people and they like to be comforted, so they can put themselves in your shoes and be empathic. Those are all qualities that let you know you're with somebody who kind of grew up all the way.
Well, let's say you're with someone who, you know, does things that hurt your feelings, and you tell them, and they apologize. And they apologize, and then they apologize again. Is that, I mean, they're being respectful. They're offering you an apology. Is that a sign of maturity?
That's a great example. You know, that's what kids do. Kids learn that apologizing gets them off the hook. That doesn't mean that they internalize it and want to change their behavior necessarily. It just means that that's what works in the moment. So when somebody apologizes for something, yeah, maturity would be if they didn't do that anymore, or, here's another one, they caught themselves doing it and stopped. That shows that they took it in and processed it. By and large, if you listen carefully, though, when emotionally immature people, quote, apologize, it's often something that is kind of superficial and sort of makes it sound like it was your problem originally. An example would be, I'm sorry you feel that way. I didn't mean to do that to you. Those are examples of equivocating. And what we really want to hear in an emotionally intimate and safe relationship is, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I see what you mean. That's what we want. But when there's an explanation or an equivocating, no, we don't feel like we're in good hands. And that's, I think, the difference. But thank you for bringing that up about the apology, because that's one of those things that seems like it's mature but isn't necessarily.
Let me just extend the apology question a bit more. Supposing you have done your work and you really have a sense of what your experiences of your parents have been and what your experiences of yourself are now, and you go to your parents and you tell them, first of all, do you tell the emotionally immature parent about your newfound wisdom? And then if you do, and they say, oh, gee, I'm really sorry, is all forgiven, and can you kind of let down your guard?
that is a huge question. It's actually the topic of my next book, Pamela. My next book will be coming out in the spring of 2019. And it's called Recovering from Emotionally Immature Parents. But I'll give it a shot.
Okay, which means you realize you have to come back and talk about your next book.
I would love that.
Wonderful.
Well, the issue is sometimes it's good for you to go back to your parents and talk to them about what you feel. And that's usually... it's usually not pretty. It's not necessarily all that mature on your part. You may just want to express things to them or let them know, but it may be for kind of like the child inside you that needs to speak up. And so lots of times people want to do that when they start getting into this kind of exploration. They instinctively want to go and tell their parent about it. And I think that's a good move because it's an attempt at a real relationship with the parent. It's an attempt to be emotionally intimate with them and say, you know, this has been a problem for me, or I wish you wouldn't do this. The problem is that you have to do that for yourself, for your own mental health. If you feel so moved, some people don't. They don't need to go back. They don't want to go back. They really know that it wouldn't do any good if they went back. But if you're one of those people that want to do that, you do it for yourself. You are speaking up for yourself, but you can't do it expecting them to change. That is a complete setup for both of you. So you can communicate to them, but you go about it in such a way that you've already accepted that they may not be able to hear you, but you're doing this on the chance that they might hear part of it, and you're doing it because it's good for you psychologically. So that's I'm all for that. People spontaneously seem to do it anyway. I just always encourage them to give pats on the back for giving it a go and speaking up after all those years. But lots of times that kind of intimacy makes the parent stiffen up and become defensive or maybe withdraw and act hurt. So we do it for ourselves, but we also recognize that we might have to cope with their personalities and behavior in other ways by learning to handle them as opposed to trying to have a relationship with them.
Handling your parents, that again is another one of those kind of sticky, complicated ones. Is it ever okay to completely sever your ties with your parents?
Yeah, I think it is. My hope as a therapist is that if at all possible, you have some contact with your parents. But when parents, I mean, some parents are really toxic and they are really so controlling and so intimidating that it's hurtful to you. It's not good for you to be in contact with them. So I am fully supportive when a person needs to take a break, or I never call it severing the relationship because you're going to keep having that relationship with them inside your head anyway. So I don't call it severing, but you can step out of the relationship for as long as you need to do your own growth and self-support. So when that seems like it's the only thing that you can do, it's important to see that as a time when you actually try to see what happened and you support yourself as you're doing that work. You may not be involved with your parent, but you still are working with that internal experience that you've internalized from them. So, yes, it's sometimes necessary to get away from toxic parents. And we also do, though, want to learn how to handle toxic people so that we don't feel like we're always running away from them.
Lindsay, you have given us so much to think about on such an important topic. Is there a website or a place where folks can go to get more information about you and the work you're doing?
Yes. Thank you for asking, Pamela. That would be my website. It's drlindsaygibson.com. That is drlindsay Gibson, GIBSON.com. And there's a full website there with descriptions of my books and also some blogs and articles available.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. It is wonderful to talk with you again. And again, I'm expecting to have you back when your next book comes out, if not before.
Thank you, Pamela. That was wonderful talking to you, and I look forward to the next time.
All righty. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me, and I'd love to hear from you, the email address is PAMELA, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. You can listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to the Mind Talk website. You can also download the Mind Talk apps from Google Play or iTunes. And again, that's MYNDTALK.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.